Hey, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us today. Henrik here with Red Ice TV. Always a pleasure seeing you. Thank you for spending some of your time with us today. I think we're going to make it worth your while. We have an interesting guest here coming up, Apollonian Germ. You might or you might not have heard of him before. He does a lot of good work on research. He takes history, philosophy, different ideologies, and conspiracy into account as well in regards to what our elites are trying to achieve, a much bigger picture. Not just the little geopolitical chess pieces that are being moved around on the board right now, but the longer view, right? Where are we going here long term if the elites, the globalists, get their way? So anyway, we're going to talk about Russia, of course, and Ukraine today and see what the outcome of this is going to be. See how the elites are using, to an extent, both the conflicts, but again, also the long term agenda here, and also how kind of dissidents in the West are attracted to Russia and to Putin, maybe not as a solution to their problems, but basically I think there's a general recognition that the West is so corrupt, it's so far gone that basically the only way we can go about this is to begin anew, essentially. It needs to fall over, it needs to collapse to a certain extent, and maybe then out of those ashes something new can be built. But the question is if we're also serving someone else's agenda, if we line up with that agenda, right? What's Russia's, game here? What's their objective? Would they benefit from a West, both America but also Europe, that's, weaker, that's more internally divided and these kinds of things? Well, there is some evidence that suggests this, right? So we've been trying to be fair. We've been trying to honestly look at the situation and compare what's happening in Ukraine and how they're being used by NATO and the U.S. State Department, the CIA, and essentially what we're very so kindly called global homo, right? It's using Ukraine. It's a proxy war against Russia. And we've been trying to look at the situation just rationally and see who's acting more rationally here, right? Look, I think a trap was set for Russia. They walked into it, but to a certain extent, they didn't have an option. But they didn't want to have nukes right on their doorstep, right there in Ukraine. Now stuff about the biolabs have come out as well. So there's a lot of questions of why they're antagonizing Russia in this way. And the question is that being used for a greater purpose as well? So we've been kind of looking at Putin and Russia as like, well, it looks like they have the more reasonable approach here in this equation. And although we've never said that we justify or think it's great that Russia is invading Ukraine, we can see that basically they've looked like the adult in the room, for the lack of a better term. But so today we're going to look at the flip side of that and criticize Russia more, and specifically not Russians, the average Russians out there, but kind of in the same way that we see how the United States is being used, and the people who control the United States is using it for a much bigger purpose. It's not to the benefit of the American people that we see a foreign policy that's out of control, for example, or the debt that the country has gone into to act global police force and things like this, right? So we're going to talk about Putin. What's his objective? What's his relationship to other people in Russia, oligarchs? What about the Jewish activism in relation to Putin, right? We've spoken to other guests here in the past that kind of looking at the situation differently, and they take more of a pro-Putin stance, a pro-Russian stance. But so today we're going to take more of an anti-Russian stance and look at the flip side of this and see how people, and specifically dissenters in the West, are being used to a certain extent. But I think it's an interesting discussion and an important one to have as well. We got to look at this from every angle, from every side, try to figure this out. Is it to the benefit of us? Is it to the benefit of the objectives that we have? This is going to be interesting. So Apollonian Germ, welcome. It's good to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been wanting to get you on the show for actually some time. We were talking quite a while ago and it didn't pan out. I think it was mostly my fault. But great to have you here, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. It's a privilege. You guys are one of the best shows on the internet, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
I miss the old YouTube days where you guys had hundreds of thousands of subscribers.
We'll get there again. No, I sincerely believe alt tech platforms is where it's at. We have a good foothold on these already. And I think at least if the trajectory of YouTube holds out, then basically it's not going to be nothing on there at the end of it. So we'll see. We're still here by the grace of our viewers, our supporters and our members and everyone out there who's sharing links and stuff. We're still here despite all the attempts and the gay ops to shut us down. But before we dive into our topic here, then, introduce yourself a little bit. You have a YouTube channel. I've been enjoying some of your videos. You're educated, an educated philosopher, right? You have some background in this. You've set up you have an Odyssey channel as well. You set up a Telegram channel recently. Just tell us how you got into it a little bit.
Yeah. So, I have a degree, a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of Illinois, Chicago. I started my education at, Loyola, Chicago. And, really, my interest in philosophy came from the fact that at Loyola, I was involved in their honors program, which as part of the honors program, you had to take a course called The History of Western Thought. And at the time, that was fascinating to me just on its own. But now looking back on it after years of just getting into the depths of history and philosophy and learning about who actually rules in society and what direction they want to take us in. Looking back at that honors course, the History of Western Thought, I can see how that perspective, that genealogy of philosophical thought that led to today, it goes way back. And that's, to me, one of my main interests in my channel is exploring the genealogy of the elites, who rules over us, and the history of the philosophy that led up to today. And we're going to get it, like you already mentioned, the Hegelian dialectic aspect of it. A lot of the Marxist socialist one world government ideology that is so popular today amongst the elites, it goes back to people like Marx. It goes back to people like Hegel, who was a big influence on Marx. And those are my main interests. I mean, I get into both the genealogy of the elite and the whole conspiracy theory angle of studying politics from behind the scenes.
That's what I like about your work so much. You're well-read. And I heard you, I forget what show it was, but I heard you, this is a while ago now, but like, clearly, like, you've read up on the topic. You're not one who dismissed the conspiracy aspect out of hand here, but actually read up on it, looked into it, and realized there's a whole, as you say, it's kind of a string of thought here, string of philosophies, ideologies that like interwoves with the global elite, essentially, and how they're also managed to kind of manipulate us along the way and kind of help us, lead us around by the nose, essentially.
Oh yeah, it's fascinating to learn that a lot of the big philosophers that are taught in every university philosophy curriculum, people like Descartes, Hegel, Marx, they all have an occult, mystical side to them. And that's one of the big things that I like to stress on my channel is the fact that, the elites are often called just greedy capitalists or people who are just in it for some kind of weird, that they're motivated just by greed or material gain.
Yeah.
But I really want to stress that they're a lot smarter than that. They're a lot more far-seeing than that. And they see themselves as basically, in my opinion, undergoing some kind of alchemical,
transmutation,
right? Some kind of literally collaboration with God in the perfection of mankind.
Yeah,
and that ties into exactly the ethnicity of who's ruling over us in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, that's my background, and that's where I come at it. And I'm always looking for the trails to find out who's really behind the scenes pulling the strings. So
yeah, no, it's great. I've been enjoying your work and the things you're talking about. And again, I think you're right on that there's definitely more to it here. I think that has even revealed itself even in the course of the last couple of years, even so-called woke culture. Now we can openly see that you know, capitalist corporations. They don't even care about the profits anymore. I mean, look at someone like Larry Fink of BlackRock, right? It's all about the ESGs now and sustainable development goals and like how do we, you know, jump on the carbon credit bandwagon and how do we manipulate people? How do we, you know, even if they're running at a loss, that the most important thing is how you shape and mold humans and control things, basically, right? And again, even with the COVID thing, to touch on another thing you mentioned, but with the vaccination, the COVID vaccines and the mRNA technology and stuff like that too, that we're now entering onto a path where they're openly beginning to manipulate human DNA and altering it, changing it. Now it's messenger RNA, but it could be something else tomorrow. And most of the approaches now seems to be, at least when medicine, pharmacopoeia is concerned, is to use this methodology of going in on the gene level and actually editing, or at least giving your body the instruction it needs to begin to alter or squirt out a certain genetic code, essentially. That is definitely like an alchemical transmutational thing. And again, believe me, they're not changing us and editing us because they have our best interest at heart and they're going to make us all much better. Right? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Well, and even, you know, I've heard the theories about the vaccine somehow altering DNA permanently, but even if we assume that it doesn't, the idea that in order to live in a society, live in our society, only if we are technologically upgraded somehow, is transhumanism in and of itself. It doesn't have to alter our DNA for it to be a transhumanist doctrine. I wrote a paper about this recently that, you know, the vaccines, the idea that we have to be technologically upgraded, that we have to be basically subject to this constant system of upgrades is in and of itself transhumanism. It's the doctrine that our natural immune system is no longer sufficient to live in society. And it follows from their fundamental assumption or their fundamental premise, which is that we are fundamentally corrupt somehow. We are fundamentally
flawed, right?
Flawed. Yeah, that's the right word. Yeah. Flawed. Yeah. And that through science, through knowledge, through these great wise men that they see themselves as, they are going to perfect mankind and lead us to some kind of like heavenly kingdom, you know, kingdom of heaven on earth. And that I think is ultimately what they believe their mission is.
Yeah.
So that's what that ties into.
Interesting. For me. Yeah. Maybe we'll see if we have time later, we might return to, I might ask you more about that in the second part or toward the end or something. We'll figure that out, but let's switch over then a little bit and let's get into the topic of Russia and kind of what their stake in the game is, basically, essentially. And also how I think how people are swayed by Russia in a way. I mean, I think it's just doing an objective like scan of the situation, especially as one in our field. You can clearly see Zelensky is obviously a puppet. He's being used. You have NATO forces in Ukraine. You have the U.S. State Department. You have CIA helping them with various things. In many regards, they're even using Ukraine just straight out as a proxy. This is openly talked about now. Even someone like Liam Panetta, the ex-CIA guy, mentioned this on a show a while back. Like, yeah, if new people recognize it or not, it's a proxy. We're using it. You know what I mean? And so our reaction, looking at the elite, right, looking at the global homo cult out there, it would be like to, would be to recognize like, okay, well, if they're for something, maybe our default position should be that we have to be against it kind of thing. That is a natural reaction. I heard it put in a different way about Trump, which was very good. And they said, what was interesting about Trump is that he seemed to have all the right enemies. You know what I mean? And that's a kind of a easy then for a lot of people to kind of fall into that trap, if you will. But tell us how you approach this situation with Ukraine and Russia, because right now the pressure is immense, of course, in Western media to be pro-Ukraine. And all of a sudden, you know, nationalism is a great thing. And they are even looking the other way for so-called national socialists or Nazis, which is a fascinating thing in and of itself. They're desperately seeking it and hunting it under every corner, under every rock in the West. But then when they actually have, you know, kind of a tangible, an actual presence, let's say, in a military, in a battalion, in a military force of a nation, they're kind of looking the other way. In fact, even the ADL gave them a pass recently and just said, no, it's not so bad. They're not attacking Jews or Jewish institutions, one of the guys said that ADL interviewed for a story on this specifically, right? So tell us how you approach this in terms of like a trap and stuff, because I think, at least for me at the outset, I was like, okay, clearly they set a trap here. Russia kind of didn't have an option. They didn't have a choice, but they walked into it of sorts. And looking at it as an overview, it was like, okay, well, it looks at this point like Russia has more reasoning of why they're doing what they're doing. At least they're not, you know, maybe using another country for a proxy. But that doesn't mean that Russia doesn't have its own objective, its own goals, its own ambitions and aspirations. And of course, there are elements here where a weakened West would ultimately, you know, kind of benefit Russia as well. But take us into the topic.
Okay, so, well, I think my response is it won't address a lot of what you just said, because I'm just going to start by saying my first assumption in any global conflict and any kind of big media circus that's going on, my first assumption is that it's somehow managed on both sides to at least some extent. And I always look for some kind of clue as to how both sides are managed by the same hidden hand, because when we look back at history, anyone who's gotten into really deep into the history of conspiracy studies and analysis knows that the big bankers, the big international, you know who-ish bankers, I don't know how
you can, kosher I can you, be here. You can name them. Go ahead.
Yeah, the big international Jewish bankers. They controlled the economies and behind the scenes the politics of the whole world twice over by now. I mean, people were writing back in the Saturday Evening Post back in the 1940s that the Jewish bankers controlled the entire economy of China, of Australia, of we could see, you know, people, great researchers, in my opinion, like Anthony Sutton, blew the lid off of the USSR long ago and showed that the USSR, and other people wrote about this too, a lot of people have written about this, the Bolshevik Revolution began with Jewish funding from bankers like Schiff and
Warburg.
Warburg and the Swedish one. What was his name?
Aschberg. It was. Yeah. I think it was. Was it not? We have a television presenter called Robert Aschberg. That's his son, or no, it might be his grandson actually. He's out hunting nationalists and stuff like that on these TV shows. But yeah, his name was Anton Aschberg, or something like that. But anyway, yeah, he was one of them. He was one of the bankers. They set up something called Red Bank, I believe, that at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yep. The legacy continues to this day.
It sure does. Yes.
But you know, when you really, you got to have a long memory to understand politics today. You got to know that. Once that control has been established, they're not going to easily give it up. And if you look up right now, things like type into Google, the continuity of elites in Russia, there have been academic studies that show that the elites that exist today in Russia, the oligarchs, the so-called oligarchs, are carryovers from the Soviet Union. So if the Soviet Union was controlled and developed by these elite globalist, you know, Western corporations and Western banks, the idea that they somehow lost their grip on that region of the world in just the last 20 years or 30 years is absurd to me. And so starting with that assumption, starting with the understanding that Russia for a long time has been controlled by these international bankers, Ukraine, obviously, so obviously. I mean, Zelensky is just a Jewish gay actor. It's kind of disgusting the things that, you know, people make fun of Donald Trump for being a celebrity, TV celebrity. Look at the shit that Zelensky has done.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have both sides of this conflict at the top tier controlled by the same people. once you realize that, you got to start to wonder what the actual objective of this conflict is. And, you know, for the skeptics, we can get into a lot of the details, things like how Putin really isn't the friend of the alt-right. Because this is another topic, which you mentioned, a lot of people have this knee-jerk reaction of siding with Russia because they see Russia as some kind of haven, some kind of anti-global homo haven, because Russia in and of itself is, it doesn't allow the whole global homo zeitgeist within its own borders. But as we could show mountains of evidence for, they're promoting it in the West. And even within Russia, you know, Putin is anti-nationalist. He said it himself. He is very much philo-Semitic. He loves the Jews. He's promoted numerous Jews to top positions in his oligarchy. And so we can get into those kinds of things. But that's my basic stance on the whole issue is the continuity from the Soviet Union. We know that they were created and funded and developed by Western international powers. And the things that they do today. And so, you know, I really don't understand what I should have actually looked into this more. Why people on the alt-right are promoting Russia is just beyond me. I don't know why they're taking this stance other than, because they're misled or because they think it's cool to be opposed to the West. It's the Hegelian dialectic, like you're saying, the West has been so thoroughly demonized and corrupted that anything that looks like opposition to them becomes attractive.
That's what I think right there. Yeah.
So that's my whole stance on the issue. And if you want to get into the specifics, we could start to do that. But
yeah, let's do that, because we have a couple of clips on that too. We could save those, because that could be a good point to kind of surmise the whole situation there, basically. But yeah, let's begin looking. What would you say generally, though? Is there a looking at the situation? Obviously, I think it's different. Maybe the kind of Duganism that we saw with, like, you know, literally like altright.com and things like that. And I was, you know, briefly associated with that. Just, you know, not a secret, but. Not a big fan, not like, you know, yeah, this is the solution or whatever, but was at the time, it was a lot of that kind of weaved into it. Ironically, people like Richard Spencer has moved on and he has Ukraine flags in his bio. It's, I guess, less Duganism, at least from that point of view. But then I guess you have other factions now. They're kind of, you know, yeah, let's pray for Putin so he destroys, you know, the global homo in Ukraine, you know, kind of thing. And again, my point has been, here we have a bunch of Ukrainians, white European Ukrainians and white European Russians fighting each other, killing each other. Gruesome things are coming out now with the torturing each other and all kinds of nasty things, right? But my question is, but who benefits at the top? What's the synthesis that will come out of this at the end, right? Because just as you, I think you basically just summarize it right there. You have an elite, a clique, call them oligarchs, call it an international clique or whatever, that benefits from these conflicts, even in the bigger picture, I think, Abelonian, like the consequences now with the oil and gas prices, the food shortages issue that they're beginning blaming on this conflict now, you know, food shortage, fertilizer shortage, all these kinds of things. Well, that's just coincidentally things that have just played, it's played perfectly into things that already begun under the COVID scam, right, of 2 years of this supposed pandemic thing. And you know, that has been part of the Great Reset and plans like Absolute Zero and things like that. And I can't see that as an accident, as a side effect of, like, this dirty snowball began rolling a long time ago. And now here we have another conflict that perfectly fits like a puzzle piece into this big global puzzle that we're laying. And it just happens to be that, oh, it's checking a number of those boxes of things that they wanted to achieve. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the specifics on the financial and economic issues, I don't know too much about. I mean, I know that there's a lot of resources in Central Asia and a lot of resources in Ukraine that are suddenly becoming scarce because of the conflict. I know that both, you know, these international powers are going to profit from this kind of conflict. I know that the sad reality is that the people who are most likely to die in this conflict are the bravest strongest, probably the best men in the region.
Yeah.
And this is something that war constantly does, is it culls the herd of men that are actually willing to fight and die for their countries. And that's always a bonus for the international elites to kill off good men. And I, you know, that region of the world, I think, is a lot less emasculated than the West, and that a few good wars in that area might do the same thing to that region of the world that it did to Central and Western Europe after World War I and World War II. So those are the kinds of things that I think about in terms of this conflict. I also think that in terms of the larger objectives, the bigger agenda, and we could sort of build up to this too at some later in the interview, I suppose, but just to lay all my cards on the table, my opinion is that the global elites know that they cannot suddenly roll out a one world government, even though that's what they want. I think that's what they want. Ultimately, they want this one world global totalitarianism. But they can't do that at this point. You know, it's not something that is feasible. So the next logical step toward that is this, what Dugin calls multipolarity, and the creation of power blocks. And I think the creation of like a Eurasian power block will stimulate the creation of a Western power block. And this is, it'll cause a more complete consolidation of power in the West versus power in Eurasia. And this is something that even Richard Spencer, who I think you just mentioned, talks about as a good thing. You know, he promotes this as a really good thing, that this conflict in Ukraine is causing NATO and the West to be more unified. And it's something that's really like, creating more definition, creating more of a clear identity of Western civilization as opposed to Eurasian civilization, and that this this impetus of this conflict between the West and Eurasia is a good thing for the West, because it's going to further consolidate the political identity of Western civilization. So I think that's kind of the Orwellian, the Oceania versus East Asia, Eurasia,
Exactly. I was just going to say that, right? It, to me, it looks like it's these, you know, you have to have a hardening of these two forces, first of all, if you want them to go to war, right? I mean, if because ultimately, I think we're talking about an elite that wants a culling of the population. And war necessarily is depending on the nature of it, though, of course. You know, nuclear war, well, you know, this could be nasty. We have now technologies, biowarfare, chemical warfare, things that we didn't even have in the Second World War, for example, right? But sometimes, I was going to say, warfare might not be the best, you know, method for it. But a consequence for it, the fallouts afterwards, supply chain issues, food shortages, diseases, starvation, you know, these kinds of things, that can be quite effective. But my point is, I see it as the West intentionally antagonizing, making it, you know, the worst they possibly can, as opposed to like mediate. I think we should be on good terms with Russia. We should trade with them. We should buy oil and gas from them. That's not a problem. We did it before. Now we're shooting ourselves in the foot, right? Which will weaken the West. It will weaken our people. We will ultimately also suffer from that. And I see that that's part of the game, right? So they're doing everything they can to harden themselves and to, as you say, kind of push Russia into the hands of China. You'll see that cooperation much closer. They're forming kind of a, I don't want to call it an axis, but you know what I mean when I use the word, like with Iran, even India now, they're you know, oil trading with them, China. That's large population numbers right there. And it's also, I mean, India, China, that's not like low IQ countries. That's like high IQ, you know, generally people. For the most, not always, but for the most part, right? And the elites, the globalist elite, can do an awful lot with that, right? And so ultimately, I see, and I want your take on this, but they want a clash between these two hardened forces. And that, I think, is the synthesis out of that, out of a third world war. I guess that goes back to Albert Pike or something, you know, the letter he wrote. But out of that, you will have a kind of a new world order phoenix kind of rising out. What do you make of it?
Oh, yeah, that... I mean, Essentially, I agree with that. I think that we're going through an intermediate step toward that. Like I said, you have to have these intermediate steps. You can't just jump from these regional nations to a global government. We have to go from, and I think that they tried that. They tried that immediate jump to a one world government with the whole world revolutionary communist push
right.
that started in the 1800s and culminated with the Soviet Union, and they tried. You know, the elites are not. I don't think they're stupid. I've said that, and I don't think that they're beholden to one particular ideology.
No,
that's something that I think people, you know, get confused about, is they think the elites are just communists or the elites are just capitalists. Now they. The elites use these different ideologies as tools, and whatever is most auspicious at the moment, whatever is most beneficial to them in the moment, they will implement. And so I think they gave up on this idea that they could just force the global population into one total state, and that they've realized that they have to sort of appeal to more localized aspects of our different nationalities and our different races. And this is something that Dugin does, I think, in his Eurasianism. And you know, Dugin, for the audience, I don't know, most people probably know.
They probably know, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Like
he was in vogue in the alt-right for a while. Lauren Southern did an interview with him. He was involved with Arctos. He was getting, Richard Spencer was having his wife translate his works into English, and he's known as this advisor to Putin.
And was that the guy they called Putin's brain for a while? Didn't they call him that?
Yeah, Putin's Rasputin or something
like that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've had people challenge me on that. How much influence he actually has with the
right.
Russian government, I guess, is questionable.
Yeah.
I mean, he does have connections with some top brass in Russian military.
Yeah.
His family comes from a high position in the KGB. His dad was like a lieutenant colonel or something in the KGB. So regardless of his actual pull with the Russian administration at this time, I think that he's in the know, so to speak. He's involved in insider circles, and his understanding of the world and his sort of prescriptions for how Russia should proceed, I think, come from a place where he has intimate knowledge with these insider circles, and that he has his finger on the pulse, and his ideas don't just come out of nowhere. I think his ideas actually, regardless of his actual influence to Putin, his ideas come from a place where he sort of knows what's going on, and it's not just out of left field, I guess I'm saying. So
right.
and he's still a good bellwether.
Right. And it looks to me that the interest here is a lot. It has been focused, at least from his point of view. And of course, that's not all of his work, but it's to talk with Western dissidents in different settings. And sure, yes, I mean, these are not groups that hold any political sway or something like that. But at the same time, you could argue there is an undercurrent, right, in the West, and again, for obvious reasons, it's not that we're against that. I'm not against that, but it's clear that it's something that could be utilized by someone who seeks to let's say undermine and not for good reasons, but for nefarious reasons or for other objectives, right? But been to talk with the dissidents and lifting that out, and then this weird thing happens where like he talks with people on the far right or whatever you want to call them, even white nationalists, but then he has this very, at least from old quotes and even some new ones as well, where he's clearly anti-white. And I was like, this is interesting. I guess, again, it's kind of, he's like a restoration of like the Soviet, ex-Soviet bloc with Asia joined, like a Eurasian supercontinent that has nothing to do with race. It's kind of like a Sivnat type thing, right? But then at the same time, you know, it seeks to benefit like a restoration, I guess, of the Russian Empire, but even greater, even bigger, I guess. I'm not sure how to explain it, to be honest.
Yeah, well, he was involved in a lot of like occult circles in his early years. He was like a Satanist for a while. And when I listened to him talking to in his interview with Lauren Southern. I just listened to that today, so it's fresh in my mind. A lot of what he said is basically the most it's the most presentable he could make ideas of things like theosophy, I think, is basically what underpins his political theory. He promotes things like tradition, but he says that Western tradition is basically the same as Islamic tradition, and that when it all goes back, when you get down to the deepest roots of things, then you find that these two traditions are the same, and that this kind of like Sikh, you know, there's a lot of people out there, I think, online in dissident right circles who believe that there is this kind of universal tradition of truth, and it ties in with theosophical thinking. But that I think is what will underpin the New World Order religion ultimately. And every region will be able to have their specific religions. But they're going to all tie in with this sense of universalism, that every religion has its roots in this one universal truth. And Dugin promotes that kind of thing. So his Eurasianism, you know, his old ideas of geopolitics and things of that nature, where he talks about how the region and the politics of the region are so intimately tied, and that's why, you know, Eurasia has a certain political outlook, because it's a continental power versus the Atlanticist power, because their power was based in their navies and based on their travel of the seas. He takes into account this regional specificity, but in the end, I think he wants to establish a universalism that unites the two, that goes deeper and unites them. So he's definitely anti-racist, because you can't have this hierarchy. You can have difference, and that's what he says. You know, we can admit that there's differences between the races, but you can't have this hierarchy necessarily. And that's something that, you know, ties in with exactly what's happening in Russia, I think, is following that sort of trajectory.
Let's go through some of that, because you put some good links in, and this really kind of underlines this point as well. The first one was from this one, arctogaia.ru, like I guess a Russian side, right? But I had to translate it as well. Do you want to read the quote, or do you want me to read that? You had it in the doc there.
Sure. Where he talks about, he's talking about white racism in this quote. It's much farther down the page.
Yep, I got it highlighted right here. Let's see, where is it? There, right there. There it is.
So he says, white racism, apart from extremely peripheral and inconspicuous phenomenon, is a completely disgusting Atlanticist thing, and at the root of many great geopolitical catastrophes. The notorious unity of the white race is as stupid as the notion of a united Christian world. This is the most harmful Atlanticist PR. So to understand the terminology here, you know, Atlanticist, that's his term for white Western civilization. He sees them as having their power based around, like I said, the Navy and the sea and trade, especially because of the ability to trade over long distances and colonize different places through sea power. So, you know, Dugin's involvement with the alt-right, when this is part of his philosophy, is kind of silly, because the alt-right ostensibly is supposed to be about raising consciousness for white people and getting them to realize that we are a unique race, and that our survival is essential, and that we want to survive. We want to be united, in a sense, in our survival. So that I think is something to consider for people that are big on Russia and on Dugin and these sorts of things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that's important. It's important to be aware of those kinds of things, right? Yeah, and you had another one. I was actually looking for the source right here. I'm not sure if this is the one. Was it from, let me see here, it was from the Foundations of Geopolitics, right?
Right. So this, I didn't write the page number down. If you have like a PDF of the book, I'm sure you could just Control F and find this quote, but He says it is especially important to introduce geopolitical disorder into internal American activity, encouraging all kinds of separatism and ethnic, social, and racial conflicts, actively supporting all dissident movements, extremist, racist, and sectarian groups, thus destabilizing internal political processes in the U.S. And this people who like to say Dugin has no influence, this is especially important because this is what Russia's doing. This is exactly what Russia is doing. I don't know if you were able to find the quote.
This might not actually be the right copy. Maybe it's not even the right book. As you can see, the title is in Russian there, so I might be out on a limb here. But point taken. You read the quote, and that's what you know where it's from. So yeah.
Yeah, it's different translations will probably have different exact wording, but the point is that you know this is the modus operandi of the Kremlin right now, and there's all kinds of evidence for the fact that Russia has been funding both sides of so-called extremism in the West. You know, they're involved with Black Lives Matter on one side and also with the alt-right on the other side. And you have to wonder why that's happening. I think that ultimately the reason is that it's to weaken the so-called unipolarity of the United States control. And you know, even putting it that way, I hate to put it that way because it's not really the United States in control. This is a controlled demolition of what was a hegemonic power block, and it's breaking it down into multiple power blocks in order to recombine them into larger regional superpowers, I would say. You know, the United States can't have total power anymore because the United States can't be independent anymore. It has to be brought in and coalesced with Western Europe, I would imagine, and Australia, I would imagine, to bring it into a larger political block. You know, so the United States has to be weakened. It has to be ultimately eroded. The independence of it, the autonomy of it, has to be eroded and destroyed to subsume it into a larger collective.
You can't have nationalism. You can't have people running around out there, you know, being patriotic and pro their heritage and history and stuff. We're talking about the creation of a new man here, essentially. I mean, a new system, a new man, a whole new concept. You have to deracinate people, whether that you tie them to a new age religion, something occult or something even existing, right? So let's assume maybe they run with Abrahamic religions, but they just see a kind of a syncretic solution to it, right? There's even, I came across it the other day, it's a little bit off topic, but like, the Abrahamic family house, was it Abu Dhabi? United Arab Emirates is building three huge squares, like cubes, basically. And one is a mosque, the other is a synagogue, and one is a church. And there's, you know, they're beginning like that kind of a syncretism or like, you know, unification of all the Abrahamic faiths, basically, right? But yeah, so that's why you have to have that erosion. You can't have, as you say, like, you know, American exceptionalism and patriotism on the forefront of a new global system. You have to erode that back home while you're promoting a new kind of thing. And maybe for a time, you know, they could use America for this too. This segment of the population, because this is not about fulfilling Americans' interests or what they want, right? This is by using the power and the economic means that America, I mean, certainly still have to a certain extent, but what, $30 trillion in debt? I mean, it's just a matter of time before this house of cards falls apart, right? And when it does, they will make their move. But it used to be used as a enforcement arm, right? That's why you had America, and those who control America, especially its foreign policy, go to foreign countries that, for example, didn't have a central bank, coincidentally, and bombing those countries back to the Stone Age and then rebuilding it up again with basically, you know, global homo, so-called democratic policies. That's all part of that game, but I feel that time is kind of like coming to an end for America, that they've used it up, essentially. And so now we're entering into a new phase. Is that correct, would you say?
To some extent, yeah. You know, there's something called hegemonic stability theory, which basically, you know, from the Wikipedia page, it's a theory of international relations rooted in research from political, economics, and historical fields. We're basically an international system. They say an international system is more likely to remain stable when a single state is the dominant world power or hegemon. Right. And if you look back into the history of, you know, the classic conspiracy theory histories of like the Venetian black nobility and how it moved from Venice up into Amsterdam and London,
yeah,
with the East India companies, and then how it moved from there into the United States to some extent, you know, how it's the core, the headquarters, so to speak, of the power elite, moves depending on what regional power is going to be most beneficial for its ultimate international plans. And that phase of the whole conspiracy, so to speak, it has to come to a close at some point. You can't just have the hegemon moving from region to region forever. You have to be able to eventually break it down and have the whole world unified. And I think that they do want to move into that phase eventually. And the United States, maybe there will emerge a new hegemon after the United States falls, but I think it'll be after this breakdown and then recollection, this recoalescence of powers into, like I said earlier, more supercontinental powers. That's the next stage.
Regions. So, yeah, exactly. Just blocks. You know, Europe will be even Europe internally will divide it up. Now it's the EU, which is borderless essentially, right? And then it will just be segments of, depending on the landmass, I guess. But you know, and kind of a warning here too, I guess. It's like that's as the Frankfurt School said, right? We'll make the West so corrupt that it stinks, right? And it's easy to go along with that plan because it does stink now. It is corrupt. It's out of control. It's teaching fourth graders how to do blowjobs, right? They're doing sexual reassignment surgeries. They're promoting hormone blockers behind parents. I mean, the crazy stuff like that's happening in the West. It's like, let's just burn it all down kind of thing. But in that process, we're also kind of, we got to make sure we're not doing someone else's bidding in that process, as opposed to, let's say, well, shouldn't we maybe, and I'm not saying like, oh, politics is all a political solution, but I'm saying just working internally in our countries that we have, like, we need to get good people, good men in positions of power again to restore some kind of normalcy, perhaps. Look, maybe the only solution is to let it fall. I don't know, right? But it is interesting that we always have to kind of think about that. Does what we advocate kind of play into a bigger agenda? And essentially, are we being used as tools, right, in that process?
Yeah, those are good points to make. And going back to the issue of Russia being anti-Globo Homo, this position that a lot of some influential people on the alt-right take, which is that, you know, Russia's based, they're nationalistic, they're anti, you know, gay, feminist, all that kind of degeneracy that is being pushed in the West. I think the reason that Russia gets away with that is because they've already been broken down. They've already had their people so thoroughly demoralized by the totalitarian Soviet state that they don't need to implement these tools in their own society. And they continue to do it in the West. They continue to, like we just showed, you know, supporting all kinds of extremist movements and whatnot in the West, promoting things like Black Lives Matter to foment this kind of conflict. This breakdown of our society into different warring sectarian groups, and the liberalization, the liberalism, I should say, the individualism of the West, that was never really the end goal of anything. That's always been a tool to break down a society and make them more malleable. It's always been, you know, it's uh, the dissolve and then recombine type satanic motto that they
had. Yeah, the old alchemical, it's solve et coagula, right? Dissolve, right. And then put it back together again. And in that process, you put it together in the shape that you want. It's an opportunity to fold it anew, right? Or right. Mold it, so, I should say, yeah.
So a lot of the people that promote Rush and Dugin, they point to the West and say that the West is liberal, and we're against liberalism. But liberalism is only a means to an end. It's not the end in itself. And Russia doesn't need liberalism because they've already had their society completely just ravaged. The Russian people were subject to, I think, worse. Worse treatment. I mean, look at Alexander Solzhenitsyn's works. They're subject to worse treatment and psychological and physical abuse than I think any other society on earth. So they don't really need that club beaten into their skull anymore. They're already malleable.
Right.
So that.
And again, to emphasize that point, it means just like in the U.S., it's not your average Russian that's benefiting from any of this or even doing any of this. It's as usual, it's always an elite at the very top that's using nations, different ideologies and objectives for a kind of a higher purpose, right? But you had this piece here too. The Atlantic is one option, another example. And you brought up Heimbach. And of course, he's flip-flopped, interestingly, in recent times as well. And I guess he just came out full Nazbol here. What was it, last year or was it a year and a half ago, something like that?
Oh, yeah, that was pretty.
That was pretty interesting.
Pretty ridiculous. I don't know how anyone could have ever looked at him.
And, yeah,
you know, I'm a believer in physiognomy, to be honest. So you take one look at the guy, and that's typical of I think the alt-right. Look at Richard Spencer, who used to be very pro-Russia, and now he's pro-Ukraine, and he said. I recently heard a soundbite on, you know, Martinez Perspective, that his show, he included a soundbite of Spencer saying, oh, well, you know, at the time I was pro-Russia because my wife was Russian and she had a lot of influence on me. Yeah, how can you take a thinker seriously if they're going to base their position on this major issue, on the question of Russia, based on the fact that your wife is Russian, and you're going to let that completely control your mind on the issue? That,
yeah,
because call into question all his other opinions, because he's got a lot of other connections, and if his wife is able to influence him that much, imagine what his other connections, how his other connections influence
him. Well, yeah, so some people say it's just an agitator at this point, or like, you know, obviously used maybe enough. Look, I don't know about any of these, but like, you know, maybe there's enough feds that threatened him with other lawsuits or something. Anything is possible at this stage. No, you're right. The flip-flopping is always suspect like that. And he flip-flopped on that issue and then deflecting. I remember he even fought with me. This is back in the early days of when they had, you know, when he had set up the altright.com website and stuff of, you know, the Holodomor. I was like, arguing is like, hey, look, they intentionally killed a bunch of Ukrainians here, and look at what ethnicity did it and whatnot. And he just like started fighting me on it publicly on Twitter. Like, first of all, is this really the best place for this? If you have take it behind the scenes or whatever. But then it was like, what, are you kidding me? You tell me you're trying to look the other way now? And that's actually kind of part of, I guess, what they've been trying to do recently, right? It's this, nah, it wasn't that bad. And you put in a couple of articles on that too, how they're kind of like trying to sanitize the old things that happened a little bit under Stalin and some of the other leaders there as well.
Right. Well, and just I guess the last thing I'll say about Spencer, because I don't like talking about people in particular, but
well, he's irrelevant now. Spencer doesn't really matter, you know. So
it's not even the flip flopping. It's the reason for the flip flopping. I mean, you can flip flop if you say, oh, I had this opinion because I thought that this fact was true X, Y, and Z, sure. And then I found out that A, B, and C were true, and that changed my mind. He's saying that he had the opinion about Russia because his wife was Russian. Like that's not a serious.
I don't think that's honest either, to be honest. I don't think that's true. I think it's just making that up. Just blaming on the wife because she's out of the picture now. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Anyway, so this is the quote you had from Heimbach here. I see Russia as a kind of the axis for nationalists. And that's not just nationalists that are white. That's all nationalists. So I guess it's a international nationalist haven then?
Right. Well, and we can do like, you know, the Curb Your Enthusiasm meme edit where you cut to the next quote and it's Vladimir Putin in a Kremlin press statement saying Russia considers any manifestation of nationalism and xenophobia to be destructive because we are a multi-ethnic country.
Yeah.
He goes on to say we need to work to eradicate the roots of all nationalism and anti-Semitism, too. So where these guys came up with this, this was like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I'm pretty sure, this Atlantic article.
Yeah.
It was very in vogue at that time. You had Spencer at a rally screaming things like Russia is our friend. And, you know, it was pretty much the status quo among the dissident right at that time to consider Russia this great bastion of nationalism. At the same time, Putin is making official statements that nationalism is antithetical to Russia's official positions, political position. So
yeah, you know what? I have two. We could play two. It's more humorous, but you know, it can still be a good place to do it. Two clips. One is Dugin here. Right, he's being asked by Ed Dutton regarding who's Russian. Listen to this.
If a group of blacks move to Russia, learn Russian, become Orthodox, and say they are Russian, would you accept them as Russian?
Yes, exactly, absolutely. Absolutely. The Russian is about heart, not about the skin, about the center, not about surface.
Which is interesting because that's also a very, that's what's the term I'm looking for, very flat, you know, kind of approach to what people, what actually is real regarding race. If you just think that it's skin deep, I got news for you. It's more than that. Guess what? So you're taking that very mainstream Western liberal global homo approach to the question here, and it doesn't differ anything, of course, of what. Well, you could argue, just to be fair here, you could argue that the West has gone further than that now, and they're actually beginning to recategorizing people based on race in many universities and things like that. But again, that's not because they believe in race. That's because that they can single out white people and uniquely suppress them and keep them away from like institutions and stuff like that. In other words, it has flipped from like not seeing race to seeing race for the purposes of singling out whites. What do you think?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think that whites are a special target of the elites because of our unique history and our unique, I would say, you know, racial spirit. I think that we are particularly strong-minded people. I think that we historically have been, you know, a race of, if we're going back far enough in time, to the tribal days of the Germanic and Celtic and Nordic peoples, I think that we in our natural state were basically an aristocracy of equals in a lot of ways. And that spirit has manifested, it's sort of been corrupted and still manifests as this individualism, this sense of anti-government, anti-tyranny, resistance. And we, I think, are the only people in the world who offer any kind of serious resistance to their plans. You know, I have nothing against other races. I have nothing against, you know, I work with a lot of people of other races. I've grown up around them. I was friends with them growing up, and I know people of all different kinds of races. But the honest truth is that the average non-white person is way more malleable. They're way more subject to being controlled, and they're way less likely to be like savvy to what's going on and willing to resist. So yeah, white people had to be a main target of this cabal that wants to rule the world.
Yep.
So
you're right, absolutely right. Hey, I have one more, by the way, here. Look at this one from Dugin. Kind of interesting. bringing up, evoking Zbigniew Brzezinski, the old, I mean, he died here, what is it, a couple of years ago now. Still has a daughter pushing a lot of propaganda on MSNBC. But Dugin talking about how this whole the global chess piece here, or the chess game. Listen to this here.
Chess board game. My mission is to help to Mr. Brzezinski to move the figures on the chessboard. There is no other option. No Macron, no nobody, no Trump, no Scholz. Please move the figures as I told you. It's your mission.
Chessboard
game.
Interesting, huh?
My mission is to help to Mr. Brzezinski.
There we go. Go ahead. What do you make of that? That's kind of interesting, huh?
Oh yeah, that. I mean, Dugin has more influence than people think. I do believe. You know, he's one of these intellectuals that I think does have some pull in the elites. So we have to take him seriously. But
yep, that's where it is. All right, so let's move on here in the order a little bit. And talk about, so we've had a kind of an attack, really, and that's what you're summarizing here, really, is on far right groups in Russia. To underline that point more, there's a couple of articles on this here from Al Jazeera: the death of the Russian far right, how the Kremlin destroyed the far right in Russia while backing it in the West. Interesting, right?
Right. Yeah. The more evidence, and there's other articles we could pull up about specific so-called white nationalist leaders in Russia that have been jailed, that have been persecuted by the Russian government. So, you know, that they're not the axis of nationalists. You know, these guys are 100% opposed to nationalism because they see Russia as a multi-ethnic country. And like Dugin just expressed, you know, being a Russian just means that you speak Russian, that you appreciate their culture, that you acquiesce to their cultural norms and whatnot. So that's also why they're one of the biggest importers of migrants in the world. You know, in terms of just numbers, I think they accepted more migrants than just about any other country in the world over the last few years. So, and a lot of those migrants come from Islam, which ties into other things that Dugin has said about at the core of traditional Islam and traditional Christianity is the same truth. This is just more evidence, more nails in the coffin for people who think that Russia is based and nationalistic. And that idea, I should just be completely abandoned. I don't know how that's defensible at this point.
Yeah, exactly. People were, it was kind of more of a joke, but it was funny because, you know, people can criticize it in the West and look the other way when Putin says it, I guess. But there was this, it was a soldier recently was dying, and then Putin had a speech and said, evoking the, I am all these different groups. We're this together. You know, I'm a Lok, I'm a Dagestani, I'm a Chechen, I'm all these things. I'm a Tartar, I'm a Jew, I'm an Ossetian, right? And then some people lined up Cuomo's speech right after this. And you know, this is the same energy here. Listen to this.
I am black. I am gay. I am disabled. I am a woman.
I am a woman. I forget what he says after that. It cuts off, but
it's all true.
It's all true. That's right. So that's kind of funny how that works, right? Again, I mean, look, the point here is, too, that they have their own aspirations, their own agenda, their own things, and there's an awful lot of people that's projecting things upon that and making it something which is, you know, which it clearly is not, and it's up to us to kind of objectively try to identify what's going on, what's happening over there. And I've heard things that you said as well, other things like they have a birthrate problem just like the rest of the West does to a certain extent. Sure, as far as I know, you know, they have banned, like, you know, propaganda against, aiming homosexuality towards kids and stuff like that. And that's certainly more than the West currently is doing, right? But then there's other issues. There's a lot of alcoholism. I'm a little fuzzy on this, but I've heard some people generally say it, that, like, yeah, you might have an elite kind of in Russia, like those who are running things. They're very you know, on the surface, that's Christian, it's Orthodox Christianity. Most of the representatives in government or higher up positions, they tout this, they talk about this, that's what we are, kind of thing. But then under the surface, there's still a lot of secularism and, I'm not gonna say atheism, but a lot of people that are overall are disconnected from it. Look, there's large segments that are also Orthodox, but it's not this. I hear sometimes from Western commenters, like, everybody runs to church there and everyone's super religious and super Christian, and that's why it's such a, you know, great, wonderful thing and a wonderful option compared to the West. But that might not necessarily be true. What do you know about that?
Well, the idea that, you know, there's this big resurgence of Christianity in Russia after decades and decades of official atheism by the Soviets, and the actual, like, the complete eradication of the Christian church in Soviet Russia, it's suspect to me, you know, that if you had this government that has this continuity with Soviet Russia, and the Soviet Russian policy was officially atheism, and they eradicated the Christian church, then seeing some form of Christianity reemerging there makes me think that it's done for a specific purpose with new objectives in mind, and that it's controlled now. And you know, I think that going back to what Dugin has said about the philosophy of Eurasianism and his whole understanding of religion and traditionalism as a whole, it could be just another form of co-opted religion, the same way that the Catholic Church and Protestantism in the West is co-opted by the same international powers, and that it's used to basically just mind control people and pacify them, and that you know, that the ideas of traditionalism I think appeal to a lot of people in a reactionary way, and so they want to use traditionalism. They want to dress things up as traditionalism while inserting at the roots of it sort of fundamental ideas that subvert it and make it universalistic and make it sort of this religion of tolerance and democracy and anti-racism, anti-sexism, these sorts of things. So in a way of, they call it traditionalism at the same time as having it subvert a lot of the elements of traditional culture that would create opposition to the globalist agenda. So that's my take. I haven't gotten into the study of the Orthodox Church in Russia at this point, but I know, like, you know, E. Michael Jones, he's a Catholic, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But he talks about how the Eastern Orthodox, how he has a lot in common with them. I've heard him say that.
I'm not sure. I've actually heard him talk too much about the Russian Orthodox stuff. I know his work on the West more and Jewish influence and things like this, but you could be correct. You could be correct very well.
I could be mistaken too, but right. the parallel that I'm trying to establish here is someone like E. Michael Jones, who's a hardcore Catholic, who believes in the Logos, a word, by the way, that Dugin uses as well. He has said the same exact thing as Dugin with regards to Michael Jones has this idea. There's a clip of him saying that he would rather have a nation, something along these lines. He'd rather have a nation of black Christians than pagan or atheist white people, or
right.
something along those lines. So
yep.
It's the same fundamental take on spirituality, that we're all, as long as you follow along with the one true religion, you're good to go.
Yeah, exactly. There's no recognition of race, importance of race or group belonging or stuff, and it's always an external thing that can come in and kind of unify, and in my view that would be artificial, and maybe not to people that actually 100% genuinely, you know, believe in something or whatever. They might for a while be able to look the other way, but usually those societies don't last. You can't keep that throughout generations anyway. You need something else, and that's where, you know, that's why we put emphasis on race, ethnicity, culture, heritage. This, it's a combination of things, and it's multiple people pieces to this that have to click for us to be able to have a functioning society. But to look the, completely the other way for race, I think it's just foolish and inaccurate as well, right? So in the second part, Apollonia, I want to get into this issue a little bit of basically, you know, Russia and the Jews, right? All the oligarchs, did he kick out all the oligarchs? What is the influence of them now? Is there a lot of Jewish activism in Russia? Is it Putin that's doing all of this? And what's his relationship to this more directly, you know, kind of thing? Because that's an interesting question. And to see if it's like, is it an elite that's controlling things there? Or is it just Putin, like the West says, that he's the autocrat, he's making all the decision, it's kind of down to him, right? What else do you want to talk about before we round up the first segment? Because I want to make sure we get out some of the points that you do want to get out so we don't cut off too soon here.
I suppose that'd be a good thing to get into in the second segment. There's a lot to talk about with Russia and the Jews, you know, the whole history, like I mentioned earlier, with the Bolshevik Revolution and the different bankers that were involved there, and a lot of the work that was done, you know, and a lot of the military deals that were done, technical assistance from the West. The technical relationship between Israel and Russia is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, Israel is one of the only countries in the world now that hasn't sanctioned Russia. Which should tell you something.
They're trying to ride that fine line, I've noticed too, right? They're trying to be a friend to the U.S., obviously, West, because that's still a big cash cow, you know, for Israel, right? So they can't openly oppose that. But then at the same time, there's this new coalition forming, right? We have the One Belt, One Road, or the Belt and Road Initiative, as it's called, which ties also together this whole idea of the, like, Eurasian power center kind of thing. And Israel seeks to be a node point in that, and, you know, be like positioned where they are geographically. That's an important point in and of itself. But they're riding that fine line where it's like, no, we're not going this way. We're not going that way. And then they've also been put in a position where they're like a mediator now in the conflict. And I could definitely see them coming in or some political figure or something from Israel to bring peace, right? Being the peacemaker in this situation. And that will somehow, you know, uplift, oh, look at Israel, they managed to do and stuff, which takes us back to that kind of old, the prophecy a little bit there of like the, what was it, the real and righteous United Nations will be positioned in Jerusalem, in Israel, right? And that will be the seat of you know, political and moral, I think they say too, religious, political, and moral power, essentially.
Yeah, like those old medieval maps that put Jerusalem at the center of the whole world.
You know? Yeah, exactly, right. I guess last thing we can mention is this guy, Prigozhin, I think you call him, right? The Wagner Group. That's another one of those things, because both sides as well here in this conflict, they're calling each other Nazis. No, it's Putin that's the Nazi. No, it's the, you know, maybe not Zelensky. I don't think they can get away with that one, calling Zelensky a Nazi. But they look at Azov and some of these other groups, right? Yevgeny Prigozhini, he's called Putin's chef, also of Jewish descent in Russia. And you linked up this article here, too. A new group of four news outlets called Patriot identified Prigozhini as chairman of its board of trustees. He's also been called, as I said there, Putin's chef. What do you know about this guy?
He's the... The Jewish oligarch behind the Internet Research Agency, which was big during, you know, the Trump campaigns and whatnot, where they were considered the Kremlin's troll factory, where they would get involved in all kinds of online discussions and try to steer and influence online discussion to cause chaos, to cause more division, to play right into the Duganistic, you know, chaos theory, or, you know, chaotic injection of extremism into the West. And he, I think, is just a great example of the Kremlin having this direct influence. And I'm sure this video will probably get comments that could have been made by Russian trolls that we're paid by this kind of figure. So
thank you for watching.
You're showing some pictures here that I'm not familiar with.
This is just because he's part of the funding, the Wagner Group, right? So that's right. Like another, they're called another Nazi, so-called Nazi outlet, but they're from the like Russian Putin-based gang of Nazis, right? But it's very fascinating to me still, right? That from Kolomoisky in Ukraine, right, of Azov, and yes, he's not currently, as far as I understand the situation, currently funding them and giving them money and so forth. But he seeded a lot of money there, specifically for the right sector, and that there's basically Jews coming in and funding Nazi groups in both countries. And now look at what's happening. A huge clash. Everybody can blame the Nazism. No, you're the Nazi. No, you're a Nazi. Let's go to war and let's kill each other. And then people don't look up at the very top of the pyramid, as usual. And they up fighting. We have another brothers' war on our hands, where both Ukrainians and Russians are going to be the ones suffering primarily because of this.
Yeah, well, and even if the banker you mentioned who funded Azov, Kolomoisky, even if he's not the main funder of it at the moment, the Ukraine government is the main funder of it at the moment, and the yeah. president of the Ukrainian government is this gay Jewish actor.
Zionist, you know. It's like, it's crazy. It's I can't see, this is the thing, we could get into this more detail in the second part, but it's like I can't, it's just so bizarre, this whole equation to me. I'm genuinely trying to just figure it out and see what the motivations are, and supposedly if they are Nazis or whatever, National Socialists, what's this, all of a sudden they're perfectly fine working with and for Jewish interests and things, and I just don't get it. Look, it's just being honest, I don't understand it. Do you?
I mean, I know Israel's making buku bucks on this entire conflict, you know, if you type in like Israel benefits from Ukrainian conflict, some Israeli military contractor company stocks have been going up like crazy, and they're funding both sides, and they're making money on both sides. But I don't think that's the main motivation. But
yeah, but if you can ruin nations and have people killed while you're making money on it, that's it's not a bad idea, right? Yeah, I saw another thing too, and I'm looking for the screenshots now. Someone alerted me to this. Here it is right here. This is interesting, right? Think of Russia then, you know, a big oil and gas provider, right, to Europe, and we've had people among the elites talking about how they want to have a cyber attack, or that our electric grid goes down, or all of a sudden they don't want us to drive, you know, gas-powered vehicles anymore. They want electric and all this kind of stuff, right? This plays perfectly into that with the sanctions now, and the inability then for even Europe to import gas. Putin later said he wanted rubles purchased for the gas, but someone sent me these screenshots here. Israel mulls European request for gas as Russia threatens to cut EU supplies. Chevron CEO says Israel gas pipeline could supply Europe amid crisis. Interesting. So they're positioning themselves as kind of a energy provider for Europe as well. Isn't that interesting, right? It just happens to benefit them for some reason. Amazing. Fantastic. But anyway, we have a lot more to talk about in the second, and I don't want to keep you too long today, so we should wrap up the first segment. Plug your stuff. Promote where people can find you, your YouTube channel, Odyssey, Telegram, Twitter, all that stuff.
Yeah, luckily I'm still up on YouTube, so go to Apollonian Germ on YouTube and check out my videos. I've been making videos for years now. There's a lot in the back catalog that I think is interesting. Gosh, you know, the one thing I forgot to mention earlier that I think is fascinating that we could probably talk about in the second segment is the influence of UNESCO and the International Baccalaureate in Russian education. You start to wonder why Putin is so anti-nationalistic, why they see their country as being multi-ethnic and so tolerant and democratic and all that. Well, it comes from the influence of UNESCO at the top level of the Russian universities. Top-tier Russian universities have these programs. And the history of UNESCO, you know, if you know anything about that, you know that they're one of the core motivators of Globo Homo and globalism as a whole. So that's something that can definitely, I completely forgot about that. That's a fascinating aspect of the entire conversation of Russia being anti-nationalistic. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. We have the links, by the way, so we'll show those in the second part. But yeah, go ahead, tell your Twitter as well. We're showing that.
Twitter right there, Telegram. I've been posting there a lot more. I used to have a Discord, but Discord keeps on shutting me down. Yeah, boy, they... that's my main lines, and I'm very interactive with people. I'm very reachable you know, if you send me a message, I will respond. I don't want to like hide behind my online persona. I feel like I don't even have a persona. I know a lot of people who make content and have some any degree of popularity kind of develop a persona, but that's not me. So if you want to have a conversation, reach out and I'll talk to you. So yeah, I'm just a tow truck driver that likes to research the history of the occult elite and their mysticism and the conspiracies that control our world. So thanks for having me, Henry.
Fantastic. I mean,
it's been a great conversation.
Yeah, you're doing a great job at it. So stay with us. We're going to be right back with part two, everybody. We'll have all the links, by the way, to Apollonian Germs, social media channels and so forth, so you can find them. Check them out down below, but we'll be right back in part two. Okay, so stay tuned here for the second part together with Apollonian Germ. We're going to get into, forbidden territory, I guess, and talk about Putin, his relation to Jewish oligarchs, what's their influence over there? Is this all of this that's happening Putin's doing? Is it his, him as a person that is personally invested in this and this is what he wants? Or is he being controlled by other forces? Is he being used, right? There's all these questions that we have. What's the influence over Putin of groups like Chabad, for example, right? There's other groups as well. We've talked about some of the personalities like Lazar, right, is one of them. And we have some clips as well that we're going to play that demonstrates this, that there seems to be more going on here than we're led on to believe. So please join us in the second part if you want to hear more from Apollonian Germ and myself as we discuss this and show some clips and look at articles that underline this. And we'll also get to the UNESCO thing that he mentioned at the end here of segment one as well, by the way. That's very interesting, right? I mean, remember, we played the clip with Klaus Schwab mentioning that Putin was a young global leader. Right. But then, you know, and Putin used to be on the World Economic Forum website. But then when the invasion happened, they took him down and stuff. So people are saying that that's proof that he's not part of the globalist elite. He's out. He's on his own. He's opposing it and so forth. Right. But again, Apollonian Germ's point here is basically that no, he's fulfilling a role. He's playing a part, essentially, of this greater outcome that is desired from our global homo friends. So anyway, join us in the second redicemembers.com. You can also sign up at subscribestar.com/redice. We have different tiers there if you want some executive producer or producer credits. Two new tiers, kind of for fun, but it helps the show as well that we've added on Subscribestar. Our month-to-month subscription is $10 a month, but if you take out a longer subscription, we have up to 2 years. It gets cheaper per month. A two-year one ends up being around $6 per month, so much cheaper. What is that? Almost 40% off, something like that, if you sign up for 2 years. So definitely check it out. We need your support. We are backed 100% by people like you. We do not have any big sponsors. We don't have any angel investors. There's not a lot of big money rolling in here like we're some BuzzFeed group or organization or something like that. So we need your support. We're 100% funded by you and therefore accountable only to you. So we appreciate you. If you enjoy the show, please consider signing up for a membership or donate. You can find more at redice.tv/donate in regards to helping us out so that we can continue to stay on the air. We are still here thanks to your support. We are still able to cover these important topics despite all the censorship, despite all the financial bannings or banning from financial services. And we can continue to try to unravel this together and figure out what's really going on so that you can stay as informed as possible in these confusing times. So thank you so much for staying with us. We'll see you in the second part. RedIceMembers.com, subscribestar.com/RedIce. We'll see you over there.